At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Swings and drives this one to center field. Deep, going back, Rosario onto the warning track. Looking up, and it's gone, a home run.
Are you kidding me?
Miguel Cabrera smokes one to straightaway center. The 2-2, swinging a fly ball left field.
Wow.
Way back in left. Justin Upton does it again.
My goodness gracious.
Hits the facing of the upper deck in left, a three-run shot. Miguel lines one to the right center field gap. That's going to get by the right fielder Kepler to the wall. Miguel needs a triple for the cycle, but he'll have to stop at second base.
Boy,
what a night for Miguel.
Just another
two doubles,
rocket.
Single, home run. That's a bullet that got to the wall on one giant hop. The 0-2. Swing and a miss. He got him on a slider in the dirt. Saltanamaki has to throw it down to first to complete the strikeout. And the Tigers make it two straight over the Minnesota Twins here in Minneapolis.
Way to go, boys.
I mean, the third inning was kind of the, you know, the undoing of the game. It was like a, you know, 40 pitch inning, you know, and at the end, the pop-up where, you know, he has a chance to get out of the inning with three, and it's a high sky, and Carlos got in front of it. You know, that's unfortunate. Not really what you're shooting for. Hopefully, you just have like 3 days of amnesia. I think those things happen. Not fun when it does, but it happens. And fortunately, you know, we won the one game 1-0. I mean, you got to give them some credit. They did a number on us.
That we just haven't been able to finish drives like we want. We've moved the ball up and down the field fairly well. And I think it's probably the right time for the team that we're facing because they can challenge you in every area. The most important thing is when you get down there and get down there close, you got to be able to come away with more than 3 points, more consistently than the next team. Yeah, so it's we're looking for that, and that's an important part of what we're doing, but that's not the only thing. It's a long list of things. There's not just one objective that we have. Football's a fairly complex game in that sense because there's so many different phases. You know, stopping the run has always been premium for us. That's where it starts, particularly against this team. They can run the ball and run the ball well, but then they also have, if you can, you know, get yourself in position, they also have the ability to hurt you in the pass game. But, you know, run stopping, running the ball at a consistent level, you know, those things are all the things that we look at.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
And a good Thursday afternoon. Welcome into this edition of the Extravaganza. Hope everybody's having a good Thursday, especially after our little storm scare last night. Hope everybody is okay from that one. It is Jim Cushland. You are hearing some technical gremlins hanging around as I've been having issues connecting with Bob's part of the studio, but we're hoping to have that back up and running. But he told me, you know, just go. So that's exactly what we're going to do as we start off this Thursday edition of the Extravaganza. Lots of fun stuff for today, and some of that fun stuff, of course, going on right now, by the way, as Tigers playing afternoon baseball. Indians had their afternoon game yesterday. Tigers have that one today, going for a sweep in Minnesota. The division lead is down to 5.5, and it's all Tigers in this one, 8-1 so far. Two three-run innings and a two-run inning, plus Daniel Norris being outstanding. A run on 5 hits, 5 strikeouts so far, 6 and a third. You have a James McCann three-run homer. Victor has a two-run double as well, two-run single for Ian Kinsler. They only have 8 hits total on the day, do the Tigers, but they've made all of them count, looking to drop the lead to about 5 games when this game goes complete. It's in the 7th right now. The Indians open a series in Texas, so it could be 4.5 by the time that this is done today with in terms of baseball. And of course, by the way, you heard something in the montage. That was from last night's win for the Tigers, the second win in that. And I'll hopefully be able to get some highlights of this of the pounding the Tigers are putting in. They just took Daniel Norris out in the 7th, not too terribly surprised. So he will go into the book 6 1/3. 2 runs as the Twins just scored again. 2 runs on 6 hits. He's responsible for a man on, but all Detroit Tigers so far in this one. You heard Terry Francona. And yeah, It's unfortunate, and sometimes those things happen. Of course, referring to the part mainly where Carlos Santana lost it in the sun. And, of course, first thing that popped into my head, even though it was blatantly sunny in this case, was that scene in The Natural. Yeah, I lost it in the sun. And Pop Fisher goes, yeah, blinding. No, it really was, but still no excuse for that. As it went in that Indians game that was dropped by the Indians, saying they hope they have amnesia, and they're going to need it because Texas is a completely different animal than the Oakland A's were. The Oakland A's are having a bad season. Billy Beane and his money ball didn't work out this year. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Meanwhile, despite all the injuries, the Texas Rangers have more or less been the number one team in the American League all season long. There have been a couple points, like 2 days ago before the Indians dropped the first two against Oakland, where the Indians pop up ahead of them in percentage points. But otherwise, since seemingly day one, despite the injuries, especially the pitching staff, it's been the Rangers in first in the American League, and that's where the Indians will find themselves, first of four tonight. So you heard some baseball in there. Also heard from Jim Caldwell as he was talking to the media. I believe that was yesterday, as they're getting ready for a preseason game number three, the so-called dress rehearsal game. That's on Saturday. A game, by the way, you can hear right here on the Ticket, 5 o'clock pregame time for the 7 o'clock kick on Saturday evening. And before he travels out to Baltimore, as that's where the Lions are, we're going to talk with Justin Rogers of the Detroit News, get the preview of Lions preseason game number three. That'll be at about 3:35. Other than that, including right now, phone lines open at 866-240-1065 here on this Thursday edition of the Extravaganza. And, you know, starting with the baseball stuff, you know, We've been talking about a lot about this, you know, over the course of the weekend, really the last couple, and we'll probably continue, obviously, as every day this gets closer means we have more of a true dogfight between at least the Tigers and the Indians. You know, despite their streak, I'm still not buying into the Kansas City Royals overall, only because they've been so bad overall this year for quite a while, despite what they did the last 2 years. I mean, we're not talking Twins or Braves or Los Angeles Angels kind of bad, which is incidentally the Tigers' next opponent starting tomorrow for a weekend series back in Detroit. But considering that they won the last two pennants in the American League and are the defending World Series champions, they've been playing pretty bad. Bad injuries, some of those young guys in the lineup weren't connecting as well. But most importantly, and this is the reason I'm still not buying into them. Yes, good you went on the streak, Casey, and got yourself to within 7.5, because they lost yesterday as well, as did the Indians. You're 4 games over .500, and it took you this long to get there. I'm not buying into you going forward, because it hasn't changed the fact that your starting rotation is still mediocre, and that's on a good day. You need starting pitching. You can't just scratch a few runs together, hope your starter goes 5 or 6, and then turn it over to a shutdown bullpen, especially considering said shutdown bullpen doesn't have Wade Davis in it right now, among other things. So I'm not buying into the Royals. But the Tigers, who with the win will go to 9 games over .500, and yeah, it's 8-2 with 2 out in the 7th, so it'll be a win. Yeah, there's a guy on first that's the responsibility of Daniel Norris, but I'll let you know if that comes around and causes a run. However, the Tigers still are in a decent position. If they hit like this, you get outings like this from Norris, for example, who, again, 6 1/3, 2 runs, 6 hits, no walks, 5 strikeouts, is responsible for a man at first, which he's not responsible for anymore, as the Tigers just retired the side heading into the 8th. So 7 in the books in Minneapolis, Tigers going for the sweep. I still like their lineup. Justin Upton's been hitting a little bit better. Miguel Cabrera, yesterday, for example, was playing old Miguel Cabrera, a homer, a double in there. In fact, he was only a triple short of the cycle, went 4 for 4. But it's some of the pitching that they've been getting. Daniel Norris. Matt Boyd, who was outstanding yesterday. And let's call, and you know, one of those credit where credit's due situation. I brought this up the other day when we were talking with Evan Woodbury of M Live, Tigers beat writer of M Live. This is a team that is also getting decent starts recently from Anibal Sanchez, who was so bad he had to be demoted to the bullpen. And you couldn't shrug it off his injuries like you did last year. So they're getting that kind of production. They're even finagling a few things. What do I mean by that? Michael Fulmer, the rookie of the year, or soon to be rookie of the year. And yeah, you guys know I'm an Indians fan, but, you know, unless Tyler Naquin decides to hit 450 over the rest of the season, the rookie of the year is Michael Fulmer's to lose. Just like Toronto's doing with Sanchez. Aaron Sanchez, not to be confused with Honorable Sanchez. They sent him down. Well, why would you do that? Because you could skip over a start to keep him fresher. As for Fulmer or the Blue Jays, who did this after he had a good start against the Indians last weekend, they sent him down. People were scratching their head. Why would you send this guy down? He's a Cy Young contender. Yeah, but he's basically a rookie who hasn't pitched this many innings, and they want to keep him as fresh as possible. So you skip a start, send him down, so maybe he gets some slight work in the minors instead of just sitting on the bench occupying a roster spot for 10 days. Tigers may be taking the same kind of approach, and I can't blame them one bit. But they're getting this production. And they also have the schedule right now. Not only are they about to finish off a sweep of the Minnesota Twins, something the Indians can't do, then they get the Angels, who are just awful. Then, starting on, is it Monday or Tuesday? Monday, they get the Chicago White Sox at Comerica Park, who are mediocre, and that's being generous. So basically, here you have a team. They went on their eight-game streak to cut it to two, as we've mentioned at times, and then more or less played 500 ball while the Indians had a better stretch. It got up to 7.5, which at the time was the high water mark, as was the Indians being 21 games over 500. Now the Tigers are going for a four straight win, which they'll get. And if the Indians lose in Texas, very possible. It is Cole Hamels in his 13-4 record against Josh Tomlin, who, despite the decent numbers overall, leads the American League in home runs allowed. Which shouldn't be a surprise. He's never been a hard thrower. He's a soft-tossing lefty, which is something the Indians, for some reason, have been liking to have over the course of the last decade or so. I still haven't been able to figure that one out, but I digress. So that could very well be a loss. And then it's suddenly 4.5 again. And when we talked about this yesterday, one of the main things that I had said was, hey, next weekend is Labor Day weekend, right? You'll be into September. High school will be 2 weeks in. It's either, and you need to be six by the second. That's what I said, because next Friday, you know, everybody marks Fridays, especially when they're done with work, is the beginning of a weekend, right? Six by two is what I said yesterday, meaning six game or more lead by next Friday, September 2nd. If it's anything less than that, you're definitely going to have a dogfight. Schedules aside, if it's six or more, it's going to be very, very tricky. We ran over both team schedules yesterday. And for the Indians, after this stretch they're in right now where they're in Texas, then they play these same Twins, who, unlike the Tigers, who have handled them easily this season, the Indians have all sorts of fits trying to do anything good against them. It's one of those quirks of baseball, because I can't find any other legitimate reason for it. The Indians then will get Miami in Houston to start September. Then after that, it's all Central Division opponents. One Minnesota, two KC, two Chicago, two Detroit, in no particular order. But if it's over six games, by next Friday the 2nd, when you're into Labor Day weekend, month ago to the season, you're going to have problems. Right now is the time, again, for the Tigers to make a move. And I'm not saying they need to be. This needs to be the middle, because if they win, it's four in a row. This doesn't need to be the middle of a four-game or an eight-game or nine-game winning streak or something. You use the big streaks to get yourselves back into it. See the Royals. See the Indians' 14-game streak that really has set them up for the rest of this summer with this big lead, which got whittled down to 2.5 about a week plus ago. But otherwise, since 14-game win streak, other than that, the Indians have been up between 4.5 and 7.5 games the entire time. Because in baseball, especially in the Tigers situation, this is why it's key that they at least stay ahead of Kansas City in the Central. Because there's still teams to climb over in the wild card. You have Kansas City nipping on the heels. Seattle's turned things around, and they're trying to stay in this. They're actually ahead of the Tigers. Actually, no, I checked that. They're not ahead of the Tigers anymore. In fact, let me just make sure I'm saying this right. No, they are not. They're tied with the Mariners, but three games out. So they don't have as many teams to climb over. Astros are trying to stay into it. There's a lot of teams still involved here. But if the Tigers can get this production from the pitching side of things, particularly some of these young guys, then it bodes well for them to stay in this thing. And if the Tigers can enter next weekend, Labor Day weekend, and be within less than six games separating, then they absolutely still have a shot at this division. So we shall see. Lots of fun baseball still to come. We're going to take quick time out, as I think we have the Gremlins kind of figured out, but I'm only one person, so I can't be in two literal places at once. So we're going to straighten this out, make sure we got Bob, and then we're going to continue the extravaganza here on this Thursday. Justin Rogers, bottom of the hour to talk some Lions preseason game number 3 coming up in Baltimore on Saturday. We'll get the lowdown on all things Lions, but back with Bob to properly start this Thursday edition of the extravaganza next here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, the extravaganza rolls on, ably handled by Mr. Cushlin for the first 25 minutes, well, about 20 minutes or so after the top of the hour Sports Center. Thank you very much, Mr. K.
No problem, that's what I do.
We got everything rocking and rolling on this end of it all now, so looking forward to a conversation with Justin Rogers of the Detroit News coming up at about 3:35, as you mentioned. And we'll talk a little bit about preseason football, the Ravens and the Lions tomorrow. And, of course, you just mentioned that the Tigers continue to beat up on the Twins exactly as they should have in that three-game series. The Indians did not do exactly what they should have in theirs against the weak Oakland A's. And so what was a 7.5-game lead could potentially be as low or as small as a 4.5-game lead by the end of the night.
Yep.
Especially when you consider Josh Tomlin, who has just become a punching bag, a human punching bag in the last month or so for the Indians, is going to be facing maybe the Cy Young winner in the American League by the time we're all said and done here. Maybe in Mr. Cole Hamels. Bad matchup for the Indians tonight down in deep in a heart of Texas.
Yeah, it's absolutely a tough matchup. And, you know, part of this is because despite the record of Tomlin, it was once 11-3. It's now 11-7. But the one thing that's been there the whole time, and he's always been susceptible to this as a lefty who does not throw hard, is that he's susceptible to the long ball. And this year he leads the American League in home runs allowed. There's no other way to spin that. That's awful.
Yeah, that is straight up terrible. So we're definitely going to have to talk a little bit more about baseball as we go on. So many other things, though, that I do want to get into, too. In NFL, by the way, congratulations to the Cleveland Browns for guaranteeing that Barkevious Mingo will now be a Pro Bowler. So that's certainly a given. I assume you saw that news?
Yes, I'm still laughing.
Yes. Anybody who gets traded from the Browns to the Patriots is probably on his way to superstardom, fame, and riches as a Patriot for Bill Belichick.
No doubt. He just seems to work that kind of magic, and it's one of those things. I mean, he didn't play well since he was drafted.
No, we never should have been drafted that high. It was one of those terrible selections made, terrible first-round selections in the last 5 years have doomed that franchise, make no mistake about it, from Justin Gilbert to Mingo to Manziel to Whedon to Richardson. Who am I missing? Cameron Irving. I guess the jury's still out on. He's going to be the starting center now. We'll see.
I'll make my decision on Irving after this year as the starting center.
Exactly, and we'll see. But by and large, I mean, just terrible, terrible first-round decisions. An extraordinarily undersized outside linebacker / defensive end. Not big enough to handle the running game coming at him, and not fast enough, even though he's very fast, to cover guys in the flat. I mean, just one of those tweener guys, and it never really worked out. But I'm sure he will be a stud in New England. So we got that going for us. Obviously, Stephen Ridley is no more. All right, he still exists. He is no more with Detroit, so we're going to talk to Rogers about that. But a few other things to get to today, Jim, and I don't know exactly how much time we'll have, but we're going to do our very best at it. There's a First Amendment case that needs to be discussed, and it's in a sport, Jim, that you and I both agree we don't really like talking about very much. And I'm talking about Hope Solo, the raging, I won't use the word, but she is. She's not a nice person. She really, really is not a nice person. She has been, you know, in trouble far too many times with the women's Olympic soccer team, or just the UN's women's U.S. national team. And now they have suspended her and terminated her contract for saying that her opponents were cowards for playing defense too much instead of offensively being aggressive in their Olympic loss. And who was it? Sweden, I think.
Sweden.
Cowards. Yeah, just a very, very bizarre thing. On one hand, you're like, good, America, Team USA, about time to get rid of her. She's an embarrassment. On the other hand, wait a second, she called them cowards. She didn't use profanity. She didn't use, you know, she didn't accuse them of being steroid cheats. She didn't do anything that was really illegal. She just said they're cowards. They didn't play hard. They played defense the whole time. And now she's booted. First Amendment, anyone? We're going to talk a little bit about that. The ESPN.com survey of the best players in the National Football League headed into the 2016 season has J.J. Watt on top of it. It's got a lot of people disagreeing. We're going to get into that. Albert Pujols passing Mark McGwire with number 584. I freaking love. Want to talk about that. Josh Norman, the fallout, still coming back from his ESPN controversial interview. ESPN.com, ESPN the magazine, in which you took on a whole host of controversial topics. I want to get into that. And Tim Tebow, working out in just 5 days, August 30th, and at least 20 major league clubs will send scouts. The Tigers will be one of them. Why is the question, and how do you feel about that? I don't know if I saw that the Indians were one. Jim, did you?
No, I've been looking for it, honestly, especially the other day when I discovered, this was mentioned in the Detroit Free Press, and Fennec and the crew, that the Tigers will have a scout.
Yeah.
With the Tim Tebow workout, which I believe is in L.A. or something.
Yeah, that's in L.A. is what I understand.
On Tuesday.
Yeah.
I think it's this coming Tuesday, so that'd be the 30th. Ever since then, I've been looking, and I have not seen any indication that the Indians are sending anybody.
So those stories are all on the table for this discussion on a Thursday afternoon edition of the Extravaganza, and of course we want to take your phone calls on them as much as possible at 866-240-1065. But we're going to talk football NFL style with Justin Rogers next. Covers the Lions for the Detroit News. That's next right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Toledo sports leader, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Once again, it's the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
That we just haven't been able to finish drives like we want. We move the ball up and down the field fairly well. And I think it's probably the right time for the team that we're facing because they can challenge you in every area. The most important thing is when you get down there and get down there close, you got to be able to come away with more than 3 points.
All right, there you go. The Lions do indeed play right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. We'll open up phone lines to you just as quickly as we can at 866-240-1065. You just heard from Coach Jim Caldwell there talking about a little bit about this preseason, which continues on Friday night, tomorrow, or Saturday, beg pardon.
5 o'clock
Saturday,
pregame time right here on Saturday.
I'm sorry, say it again, Jim?
It's a 5 o'clock pregame 5 time o'clock. For the 7 o'clock kick from the Lions. That's Saturday.
Thank you very much.
Rounds
in
tomorrow.
Baltimore to take on those Ravens,
yes.
And that's where you will have Justin Rogers. He'll be covering the Lions, as he always does, for the Detroit News, and he joins us now for a little bit of a breakdown on where things stand for the Lions headed into what is traditionally called the preseason dress rehearsal game, the game in which the starters will play more than any of the four, probably not much more than a half, though, in most cases. And, Justin, thanks so much for the time. How are you this afternoon?
I'm good. It's the preseason, so I might just keep hanging out in the Inner Harbor during the game. I don't know. Not that important.
No, it's really not. It's not for you or me or most of the fans who don't give a rat's you know what about most of these games, but it is a big deal for guys who are fighting for jobs. And with that in mind, let's launch into some of the position battles. You referenced the word logjam in your piece this afternoon about the release of Stephen Ridley. The logjam at running back got a little bit thinner. Was that a surprise to you?
It really wasn't. I'd done an early roster projection this week, and I had Ridley on the outside. You know, at this stage of the preseason, with where he was running with the offense, third-team offense, the practice reps he was getting, it just seemed like his time in Detroit was short. It's good, I think, to give a veteran like that, you know, especially one that your GM obviously respects from his time in New England, to give him a little extra time to find his footing and see if he can land somewhere else here before the preseason ends. But no, the younger kids were outplaying him both in reps and performance. Dwayne Washington's performance in the preseason has really made Ridley expendable, and so I think the last spot's going to come down to Zenner and George Wynn, and you know, right now it's looking like another year of the Zach Zenner show.
And, of course, we still haven't seen the debut of Ameer Abdullah this preseason, and I know that's something that he is hoping to rectify. He does not want to go into the regular season, apparently, without some preseason reps. I know he said in the piece put together by your colleague there at the Detroit News, James Hawkins, he said, life is about reps. He said, everything is about repetition. You can't expect to do well on a test if you haven't studied for it. So he wants to study. He wants to get opportunities in one of these last two preseason games. What is the prognosis, as far as you understand?
Yeah, I think of the three injured players with him, DeAndre Levy, and Eric Ebron. Abdullah's probably the most likely to play a few snaps in this game. You know, talking to him the previous week, we asked him, is it like how much rust do you have to knock off? And he said, it's kind of like riding a bike, you know? It's just you take one hit and you're back into the swing of things. He's been taking a lot of reps in practice, but, you know, hasn't got the contact element of it. And that's obviously a different level of preparedness. So, I think he'll be out there. He might not play the full two quarters, but if any of those injured guys play, it'll probably be Abdullah.
Yeah, he was probably a little embarrassed there. He's wearing the chick jersey for the last couple of weeks, huh? The quarterback red, what we like to call the chick jersey. Might as well put a skirt on him, too.
Yeah, I'd throw a couple jabs at him here and there when he walked by, and, you know, we noted that he got his regular jersey back, and he said, yeah, maybe I'll make the team now.
and it's important, obviously. I mean, you know, we've been talking about this the last couple times we chatted about the Lions running game, not just with Ameer Abdullah, but, you know, the depth at the position and whether or not there's going to be somebody who can step in and run the ball with any regularity. Given the other guys, you know, you just mentioned a couple of the names. You know, Riddick is just going to be a threat out of the backfield. He's not going to get a lot of carries. So his health is of the utmost importance here. And I got to believe if Jim Caldwell isn't 100% certain that he's 100% ready to go, that he won't let him run the ball at all against Baltimore or in the last preseason game.
Yeah, you know, I think Abdullah's been 100% for a while. You know, he had the shoulder surgery. I don't think they would even let him on the field had he not been. This has been more of a bubble wrap situation. They know Abdullah's their best running back, and it's not close. So, you know, by getting out there with Baltimore, like I said, just knocks off that little bit of rust he's concerned about. But, if he's not game this season, or if he gets hurt this season, that the bad situation at running back gets significantly worse in a hurry.
Yeah. And even with him, it's not a really strong situation. It's not a strong ground game. It's not a lot of depth in that backfield as it is. So you're right, it's extraordinarily important. Justin Rogers covers the Detroit Lions for the Detroit News. Bob France, Jim Cushlin alongside as well. Jim, go ahead.
And, you know, speaking of some of the guys who are wounded then and or now, Eric Ebron, well, I mentioned this in the Sports Center. You just brought his name up, Justin. He missed practice again today, and obviously this is a position where the Lions do have a little bit more depth, especially once they get these guys healthy. But he was cleared to come back the other day. He probably wasn't going to play on Saturday anyway. But what's going on? Why is he still out? I'm already hearing the word relapse.
You know, he's not talking to us. He walked into the locker room today, saw the media was in there, and just immediately turned around and went back out the area we have, you know, no access to. I'm not entirely convinced, and this is speculative, you know, this is not fact, but I'm not entirely convinced that he didn't come out with a helmet just to generate some headlines for himself and be a goofball, because that's just the kind of guy he is sometimes. He didn't really do it. We're not watching full practice at this stage. This is the first week where we're only seeing the individual drills. But, yeah, he was out there in a helmet, but he didn't do anything. And so, you know, I don't know if he was just being goofy. I don't know if he, you know, was really back to practice that day and we just, you know, got tricked. But nobody's talking about his injury status or where he's at. I still expect him to be ready for week one, but he's definitely not playing this week.
These zany guys, you know, you never know what they're up to. And they do. They just sometimes just screw with the media, just so they give them something to report on. Hey, you know, Ebron had his helmet and he might be ready to go. And who knows, in reality. Let's talk about the quarterback situation. Obviously not the starting quarterback, but Orlovsky with a couple of pick sixes in the first two games. He calls them stupid plays. I don't think most fans would disagree with that. He's taken some boos, and even, again, in another piece under the Detroit News, hearing some calls from fans saying, Rudock, if Matthew isn't in the game, we want to see Rudock. They've had their fill of Orlovsky and pick sixes.
Yeah, you know, I made the joke in a story earlier this week that the backup quarterback was always the most popular player in Detroit, not just, you know, Lions, but any sport.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, Orlovsky bucks that trend. I mean, fans just can't stand him. He is one of the nicest individuals you can meet, but he holds that stench of the winless season. You know, his play running out the back of the end zone is kind of like the iconic play to to summarize that season, and they've just never forgiven him even after the re-signing. You know, he's a backup quarterback. He's important in what he does in the film room. He's important in emergency settings, but Matthew Stafford has not missed a start in 5 years. So all in all, it's really not that important. If Matthew Stafford goes down with something long-term, say he breaks his leg, yes, the Lions are sunk. It doesn't matter who they bring in, whether it's Orlovsky or Rudock. You know, at this point, the rookie's played really well. He has, and I think he's played himself onto the roster. But
that was going to be my next question, because we talked earlier, I don't know, a week or 2 weeks ago, and you were pretty convinced he was destined for the practice squad.
I was, and you know, that's how things change sometimes. Dwayne Washington was another one. I thought that guy was practice squad all the way. He was fumbling a lot in practice, was dropping a lot of passes, but then he goes out in those preseason games, and he proves what the Lions saw in him through the draft process. And Rudock has really made strides in his play recognition in terms of what windows are acceptable for a college quarterback versus a professional quarterback to attempt to throw into. He's not relying on his feet as much, but his feet are a valuable weapon. And that's what I think the Lions really like about him, is he can scramble if need be, but now he's not doing it too quickly. He's assessing the full situation and scrambling as a last resort, as opposed to, you know, bailing on the pocket early. So I think the Lions are going to carry three quarterbacks at this point. You know, that could change, obviously, in the next 2 weeks. But, you know, Orlovsky's on one-year deal. They like what he brings as a veteran to the room. They can keep Rudock on the roster, let him develop as a game day inactive for an entire season. And then next year, when he's, you know, got that full year of experience under his belt, then they can pull the trigger and make him Stafford's backup and feel more comfortable with the situation.
The numbers for Rudock bear out what you're saying about his improvement. 16 of 22 in the preseason, 162 yards and a touchdown, and a rating of 80. The percentage, by the way, is nice, 72.7% on 16 of 22, and an overall passer rating of 89.6. So certainly making big strides in the last 2 weeks, as you pointed out. He looked kind of lost in the very early going of training camp. We're talking to Justin Rogers of the Detroit News. He covers the Lions. He will be in Baltimore for Saturday night's game. Jim Cushing got another. Go ahead, bud.
Yeah, and speaking of Stafford and the quarterbacks, Jim Caldwell kind of mentioned this. They've been mentioning this a lot, actually, that they want to see more efficiency, and this is the kind of things you're looking for, you know, in the preseason, especially in this game number three. They want some more efficiency, but Caldwell, Stafford, Golden Tate, and others, they're really trying to make you excited. One's excited about their offensive potential. Basically, Stafford and Tate saying it's going to be up-tempo and the Lions will be dangerous, and this is part of what Jim Caldwell wants to show in this game coming up on Saturday, in addition to being more efficient. We were talking earlier about the running game, so it's not necessarily that. So when these guys talk about, hey, this up-tempo offense is really going to be dangerous, explain that to us.
Well, you know, last year the Lions only ran no huddle about 3 or 4% of snaps. So far in the preseason, it's been close to two-thirds of their snaps. And, you know, Caldwell has been very emphatic that it's not all they're going to do. They're not suddenly going to morph into a Chip Kelly-based offense or anything like that. But they're definitely looking to run it more. And by doing that, you dictate the pace. You can control defensive substitutions, which are important for a lot of defenses, including the Lions. You can take advantage of your young offensive line, you know, which may still be gelling and struggling at some level, but what they have on their side is youth and athleticism. And so if you are wearing down opposing defensive lines, maybe you can play that to the advantage of one of your offensive line's strengths. I'm all in on the passing game. I think Marvin Jones is fabulous. Obviously, Golden Tate's got a track record now here in 2 years with averaging about 95 receptions. Riddick has established himself as one of the better receiving running backs in the NFL. You get Anquan Boldin, the veteran who you don't need a whole lot out of, and you're still going to get good production out of the slot in terms of 40, 45 receptions. Add Ebron to that mix, and it's just a very potent passing attack that doesn't require the quarterback to hold onto the ball too long to utilize those weapons. You know, the run game is going to be critical. We can keep harping on it, but if they can't run the ball effectively, if they can't average close to 4 yards per carry, then you know, this offense isn't going to be balanced and therefore not going to be efficient enough. What we've seen in the preseason, one of those things Caldwell's harping on is their red zone efficiency. They're getting down there, they're putting together these long drives, and then they're not finishing them. That's something they did really well last year. I'm not sure if they were top in the NFL, but they were, you know, up near the top of the NFL by the end of the season. And so I'm not going to freak out about a small sample size in the preseason. I think they're going to dial up some plays that are not vanilla in the regular season and take advantage of those red zone weapons they have, but they've got to show more efficiency in the red zone here against Baltimore. That'd be, you know, a good sign.
The obvious follow-up to me, Justin, on this and what some of the no-huddle and things that we're seeing is how much of this is an effect to the fact that Jim Bob Cooter, the offensive coordinator, now starts the whole season and isn't coming in midway. How much is that playing into this?
Oh, it's probably most of it, if not all of it. You know, and the other thing is it's the quarterback and a lot of the players that are returning are now more comfortable in the offense. You can't, in the middle of the season, expect to implement, you know, new pacing along with new plays. The fact that what they did at the second half of last season with the offensive success and efficiency that they had was remarkable. I mean, it's particularly Stafford, who completed 70% of his passes those last eight games, 19 touchdowns, two interceptions. I mean, it's just not sustainable. So what you're doing is, you know, opposing defenses at some level are going to figure out some of those basic elements. Now you're bringing in a wider scope on the playbook, and then you're bringing in pace as another element to keep opposing defenses off balance.
Justin Rogers, our guest, as we talk NFL football preseason style, the Lions and the Ravens going at it on Saturday, a game you'll hear right here. Coverage at 5, correct, Jim Kushlin?
That is correct.
Justin, you did. You mentioned your kind of starting lineup prediction that you did for the Detroit News at DetroitNews.com. I don't want to read through them all. Just ask you, is there anybody that people would be surprised over as far as selections that you have made for what you think will be the starting lineup on either offense or defense?
No, I don't think the starting lineup, anything's going to surprise anybody at this point. You know, the defensive tackle rotation's strong. You know, I think Tyron Walker is the clear-cut starter still over the second-round pick, A'shaun Robinson. You know, the one people kind of were weirded out by, I guess, was the fact that I only listed two linebackers as starters. But, you know, this is a nickel team now. Their base defense is essentially a nickel package. And we've heard all offseason they expect to be a nickel 60 to 70% of times. That makes Quandre Diggs your starter and your third linebacker in reality. Obviously, he's the nickelback. He's not a linebacker. But,
right.
You know, Kyle Van Noy is still on track to be the starting strong side linebacker. But that's a name only. Can only be out there, you know, 20 snaps a game.
All right, Justin, this is a little bit outside of just the Lions realm. The ESPN.com player ranking has been released for the 2016 season. Have you seen this, first of all?
I've peeked at it. I don't have the list memorized.
Okay, good. So you don't have memorized. I'm gonna see if you can guess something here in a moment. But first, just to let people know what they did. They do this every year. This is not an MVP vote. This is just best player on how good they are. That's it. How good they are at their job, not necessarily who's more valuable than somebody else. They rate a player, every player, on a scale of 1 to 100. 100 implies an all-time level of excellence. A 1 is for somebody who doesn't belong in the league. The panel included, and Kush, make sure you listen to this, more than 50 voters, NFL analysts, reporters, statisticians from both ESPN and outside ESPN, including former players and NFL front office members. That's what they consider. That's the group that they put together to rate every player on that scale of 1 to 100, and then, of course, the highest average scale that they were rated in that order. The top 10, I'll just go ahead and read this, the top 10 and get your reaction to it before I ask you the question to see if you can come up with it. The top 10 are J.J. Watt, best player in the NFL, according to that panel. Aaron Rodgers, Rob Gronkowski, third best player, the tight end for the Pats. Antonio Brown, the wide receiver for the Steelers, 4. Von Miller, the Super Bowl MVP, 5. Tom Brady, 6. Luke Kuechly, the Panthers' all-everything linebacker, is number 7. Aaron Donald of the Rams at number 8. Julio Jones, who tied Brown for the league lead in receptions last year, the Falcons' receiver, is number 9. And then the defending MVP, Cam Newton, is number 10. Do you have any problem with J.J. Watt, a defensive lineman, being, and we say lineman because he's not just a defensive end. You probably recall 2 years ago he was first-team All-Pro at defensive end and second-team All-Pro at defensive tackle, which is just amazing. Any problem with him being named by that panel the best player in the NFL?
Not a whole lot. I mean, he really is an incredible talent and changes games week in, week out. I think the move to end, or at least the classification of end, playing on the outside and letting him disrupt the quarterback more consistently increases that value. And I think there are three premium positions in the NFL, and it's defensive end, quarterback, and it's offensive tackle. And so, yeah, I mean, you're flipping a coin between Aaron Rodgers and J.J. Watt. And I probably, you know, most general managers, if given the pick of one, are probably going to take the quarterback because that's the hardest position to find. But J.J. Watt, to me, is a transcendent talent. Generationally, even, you know, when you look at his body of work and how consistent he is week in and week out.
Yeah, that's the reason I asked you if you had any problem with it, because what you just said, that the quarterback is the hardest position to find. It's the hardest position to play, not just in the NFL, but I believe in all of team sports. I don't think there's anything tougher from a mental and physical standpoint and a leadership standpoint and all the things that go into it than being an NFL quarterback. And that's why I wondered if D-line was okay. Any problems with that top five or beyond, as I said, just the 10 that I read to you? Rodgers, number 2, Gronkowski, 3, Antonio Brown, 4, Von Miller, 5. Brady, is he 40 now, or what is he? Is he pushing 40 this
season? I don't know. He keeps going. He's a robot.
Yeah, and the performance really hasn't dropped off very much. Then Kuechly, Donald, Jones, and Newton. Is Cam Newton the defending MVP? Is he too low at number 10?
No, I mean, I might put Newton ahead of Julio Jones. I mean, that's a quibble. You know, that's really small, but I think they did a really nice job there with ranking. I guess, yeah, I'd probably move Newton up maybe ahead of a couple, the way he played and the way he elevated his game last season, the mobility he offers. He's probably not too far away from passing Brady just on the age factor alone.
Is there anybody in that top 10 that you don't think should be? And is there anybody you can think of just top of your head that you know is one of the 10 best players in the NFL, regardless of position, that is not in that top 10?
Well, there's no cornerbacks in there, which is kind of interesting. I guess just
highest rated cornerback, FYI, is number 14, and that's Richard Sherman.
Yeah, and the Sherman, Revis, Peterson, even Norman, I mean, those guys are probably all
Peterson is two together. Peterson is two back at 16. Revis has dropped a bit. Age and maybe a step slow, that sort of thing. Revis is down in the he's not even in the top 25. I'd have to go to that part of the list to see where he is. He's not even in the top 25. You do see a couple of other secondary guys in that top 25, though, and that would be Honey Badger. Tyrann Mathieu is tied for 23rd with Eric Berry of the Chiefs. And they're both safeties. Matthew's kind of a safety corner hybrid, and then there's Barry the Chiefs. Sure. Those are the only guys.
I'm guessing Earl Thomas is up in the top 15 too.
Earl Thomas. Oh, I forgot about him. Yes, thank you. Correct. Yes, he is. Earl Thomas is at number 15, right on the button. Yes. So you got back-to-back Seahawks there at 14 and 15. Peterson, and then 17 is Joe Thomas, the highest-ranking Brown. 18, Ben Roethlisberger, which I think is quite low, given what he has done over the course of the last couple of years. They are such a different team when he is out, as we saw during the Landry Jones / Michael Vick fill-in periods. When he is healthy, that offense is as good as any in football. I think he's probably a little low there. But anybody that you think needs – I think Odell Beckham Jr., who's had a great start to his career – I don't know that I like him as high as 13, though. I need to see another one, and I need to see if he can handle being the target, as Josh Norman declared a couple of days ago, of a lot of secondary guys who think he's a punk, who don't like what he did to Josh Norman, and who really want to take this guy apart. I need to see more out of Odell Beckham before I put him up as high as the 13th best player in football.
He's kind of a clown, but in terms of talent, I mean, I would love to have the guy on my team. He just makes so many catches and runs routes so well that, you know, other guys can't do. Where's Adrian Peterson on this list?
AP was right before Odell Beckham Jr. He was at number 12.
Okay.
Yeah, 11 was linebacker Khalil Mack, who is just a stud. Game changer
awesome.
Right there at 11 with the Raiders. Then AP, and then Odell Beckham, as I mentioned, then Sherman, Earl Thomas, Peterson, Joe Thomas, Roethlisberger, A.J. Green, and then Tyron Smith, the tackle for the Cowboys, rounds out the top 20. Russell Wilson, in case you're wondering, is at 21.
See, this is the benefit of having so much input, is you really kind of filter out some of the bogus opinions, and it really kind of, I guess you get the best of everyone when you have that many opinions going into it. I think the list is pretty good.
I think you can
argue about a few spots here and there, but those top 20 players are about where I'd have top 20. I might have a few guys in different spots, but not too much.
Former Lion and Dominican Sue, by the way, rounds out the top 25. He is right at number 25. And that's what I wanted to ask you, and I know we're out of time here, and Cushion's yelling at me. We've got to go. It's already 4:01. Sorry. But real quick, what I wanted to ask you, that's why I asked if you had seen it. Cushion answered this, too. Who do you think the highest-ranking Lion is on this list, and how high do you think he will be? You first, since you're the guest, Mr. Rogers.
It's got to be Anta. I don't know, probably in the ballpark of 50 to 70, somewhere in there.
50-70, and you think it's Ezekiel Ansah. Cushland, did you look at the list? Did you cheat?
No, I have not. I have not cheated. And
who's the highest ranking line in the top 100 players in the National Football League?
I gotta say that Justin's answer was pretty good, but I don't think it's Stafford, and I'm not going with Ansah. My guess is going to be Golden Tate.
Golden Tate is your guess. Well, Justin Rogers, that's why he is the Lions beat writer and the expert analyst here. It is Ansah, and it is between 50 and 70, a little lower than I thought. The highest ranking line in the top 100 players, Ezekiel Ansah at 66. So,
but that's like Beckham. You're talking about a guy that needs to show it more. Ansah's trending in that way. He puts together another double-digit stack here, and his value perception around the nation is going to continue to go up.
I think that's exactly right. Well said. All right. Hey, Justin, we got to run. We're late. Thanks for the conversation. We appreciate it. Have a good time there in the Inner Harbor, and if you ever come back, we'll talk to you when you get back.
Sounds good. Talk to you.
All right. Thanks very much. There's Justin Rogers. I'm late. Let's get out right now. ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
He swings and drives this one to center field. Deep, going back, Rosario onto the warning track. Looking up, and it's gone, a home run.
Are you kidding me?
Miguel Cabrera smokes one to straightaway center. The 2-2, swinging a fly ball left field.
Wow.
Way back in left. Justin Upton does it again.
My goodness gracious.
Hits the facing of the upper deck in left, a three-run shot. Miguel lines one to the right center field gap. That's going to get by the right fielder Kepler to the wall. Miguel needs a triple for the cycle, but he'll have to stop at second base. Night for Miguel.
Just another
two doubles,
rocket.
Single, home run. That's a bullet that got to the wall on one giant hop. The 0-2. Swing and a miss. He got him on a slider in the dirt. Saltanamaki has to throw it down to first to complete the strikeout. And the Tigers make it two straight over the Minnesota Twins here in Minneapolis.
Way to go, boys.
Yeah, I mean, the third inning was kind of the undoing of the game. It was like a 40 pitch inning, you know, and at the end, the pop-up where, you know, he has a chance to get out of the inning with three, and it's a high sky, and Carlos got in front of it. You know, that's unfortunate. Not really what you're shooting for. Hopefully you just have like 3 days of amnesia. I think those things happen. Not fun when it does, but it happens. And fortunately, you know, we won the one game, 1-0. I mean, you got to give them some credit. They did a number on us.
That we just haven't been able to finish drives like we want. We moved the ball up and down the field fairly well. And I think it's probably the right time for the team that we're facing because they can challenge you in every area. You know, the most important thing is when you get down there and get down there close, you got to be able to come away with more than 3 points, more consistently than the next team. Yeah, so it's we're looking for that, and that's an important part of what we're doing, but that's not the only thing. It's a long list of things. There's not just one objective that we have. Football's a fairly complex game in that sense because there's so many different phases. You know, stopping the run has always been premium for us. That's where it starts, particularly against this team. They can run the ball and run the ball well, but then they also have, if you can, you know, get yourself in position, they also have the ability to hurt you in the pass game. But, you know, run stopping, running the ball at a consistent level, you know, those things are all the things that we look at.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly what it is. Welcome to the extravaganza right here, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. Kush, you know what we have not done for a long time?
What's that?
I usually save it for special occasions when I need to get pumped up for something, but I have no idea why. I am just jacked up, and I'm ready for the Rocky Open.
Win.
Let me tell you something you already know. The world ain't all sunshine and rainbows. It's a very mean and nasty place, and I don't care how tough you are, it will beat you to your knees and keep you there permanently if you let it. You, me, or nobody is gonna hit as hard as life. But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward. That's how winning is done. Now Now, if you know what you're worth, now go out and get what you're worth. But you got to be willing to take the hits. And not pointing fingers saying you ain't where you want to be because of him or her or anybody. Cowards do that, and that ain't you. You're better than that.
Oh, there it is. I get inspired. I get fired up. I don't even have anything to get fired up about. I want to go play. I swear to God, I want to go play football. And since I'm too old to play football, I want to go play one-on-one basketball and kill somebody and power dunk over them, but I can't dunk. I got to go play somebody at something. Christian, what do you say we put it on autopilot and go outside and play frisbee or something?
That sounds like fun. It's a nice day.
Beat somebody at something, seriously, right now. When you hear that, any better line in a movie than "That's how winning is done"?
That is a good one.
I just want to go beat somebody down. Christian, you want to fight? Can we fight? Punch me one time. I dare you. Can we just go at it?
I'll probably lose.
That fires me up, whether there's a baseball game tonight, whether there's a football game tonight, or if I'm playing Parcheesi on a card table with my family. I don't care who it is or what it is. I just want to win at something. That is just outstanding. You know what it was? They were talking about Rocky movies.
Okay.
I'm sorry, what?
Okay.
They were talking about Rocky movies. I think it was on First Take. I don't know if it was today or it was yesterday. Was it them or was it Mike and Mike? I can't remember who the heck I was watching or listening to anymore. It all kind of blends together sometimes. But they were just talking about, because you know what it is. The movie Hands of Stone is coming out on Friday, I think. And it's the story of Roberto Duran, the tremendous Panamanian champion, one of the greatest fighters of all time. Also known infamously for being the no mas, no mas fighter who, in the rematch after beating Sugar Ray Leonard in an epic first fight between two of the greatest pound-for-pound fighters in the world, probably in history.
Okay, now I'm on the same page, because at first I'm like, that name sounds so familiar, and then you said the no mas. Ah, okay.
Oh, that's how you remember Roberto Duran?
Sadly.
Oh, no. Oh, that is terrible. That's so sad. For him, I mean. I'm not making fun of you. That's just so sad. Roberto Duran, one of the greatest pound-for-pound fighters, honest to God, in the history of the sport. Now, did you know this movie was coming out on Friday?
No, I did not.
Oh, man. Oh, bro. You're killing me here. Roberto Duran was one of the most epic fighters in history, honestly. He was a lightweight most of his career, then got into like super lightweight and then welterweight, which is where he fought Sugar Ray Leonard. He fought Thomas Hearns. This is part of that incredible, you know, triumvirate of fighters who fought each other multiple times. They were all around the same weight class. They would each move up or down or wherever they had to go to fight one another at catch weights or whatever. But, you know, Leonard, this is the heyday of the welterweight and or lightweight divisions, to welterweight, to super welterweight, even to middleweight, which is where Leonard, after he came back, ended up fighting Marvin Hagler. But Leonard and Duran and Hearns and then Hagler, because Hagler and Hearns went at it in an epic fight. Three rounds of just straight up brutality. I mean, it was like a freaking car wreck with those two guys. But anyway, Roberto Duran is just a straight up legend, and it makes me very, very sad to know that you, as a younger fight fan, only remember his name from No Mas, No Mas. Which is, you know, I mean, obviously it is a huge moment in his career, and obviously the darkest moment of his career. But this is a guy, Jim, who fought 119 professional fights. He was 103-16. And that 16, a lot of those came at the end, you know, when guys hang
sure.
on and they think they can still fight and so on and so forth. He knocked out 70 guys of his 103 wins. One of the greatest fighters of his not just his era, but in history. And you need to go watch this movie is what you need to do. Now, I'm hoping the movie's good. Usher is actually playing Sugar Ray Leonard in the movie. I didn't know Usher could act. Can Usher act? Have you ever seen him in anything?
I have no idea. Honestly, no. I have no idea how he can act, and my only hope is he's better than Shaq.
I mean, because of this is like a boxing documentary, you know?
Yeah.
It's a boximentary. How about that? I want to trademark that right now. If
TM.
Anybody uses it, you owe me a dollar. What's that?
TM.
Yep, TM. It's a boximentary is what it is. But it's a documentary, and I wanted to do justice to that great, great, you know, little series there between Sugar Ray Leonard and Roberto Duran. But anyway, he was, the nickname Hands of Stone is because he had knockout power, Jim, in both hands. As his 70 wins by knockout out of 103 wins in his career would indicate, he could just put your lights out with either hand. And he fought Sugar Ray Leonard. This was a unification bout between, because he vacated the lightweight title is what it was. And this is back in, I want to say, 80 even. It was very early 80s. Anyway, he vacated his lightweight title so that he could make a run at the welterweight title. And he earned a pair of wins at the welterweight level against Carlos Palomino, who was a great fighter in his own day, and Zeferino Gonzalez, who is another, a good solid Latino fighter, which set up the title bout against the welterweight champ. So I take that back. It wasn't unification, but he gave up his lightweight title to challenge Sugar Ray Leonard, the welterweight champ. And he did it up in Montreal at Olympic Stadium, which is where Sugar Ray, by the way, won his gold medal at the 76 Olympics. So just, 4 years earlier, or roughly 4 years earlier. Yeah,
yeah, I was just checking that. It was 1980.
It was 80. There you go. So it was 4 years earlier. He won his gold medal there in the 76 Olympics, Summer Olympics. Anyway, but this was just a tremendous thing. Now, he went into the fight 71-1, did Roberto Duran. See what I'm saying? Why I said, oh no, please don't tell me you only remember him for Nomas. You got to remember him for the tremendous monster that he was. I mean, people feared this guy. Even though he was lightweight, they feared this guy. So anyway, Duran beat him in a unanimous decision, 15 rounds of just unbelievable boxing skill and stamina. It was incredible. They called it the Brawl in Montreal. So anyway, a rematch, of course. A fight like that demands a rematch. And he gave Leonard the rematch. Like a year later, I don't know, whatever. I don't think it was a full year, but anyway. But he fought him in a rematch, and I want to say this was like in New Orleans or something, maybe. It was in the States. It wasn't like up in Canada. I can't remember all the specifics. I'm trying to do most of this from memory. But he fought him in a rematch, and Sugar Ray kind of, he's such a brilliant fighter, such a brilliant. I know I'm really off the topic here. I didn't plan on talking boxing this half hour in the program, but I just love this stuff, and the movie's coming out. And I played the Rocky theme, so bam, there you go. But anyway, Sugar Ray Leonard was such an incredibly cerebral fighter, which is why he's one of my favorite of all time. Maybe my favorite of all time, right up there with Ali. Sugar Ray Leonard just knew how to win the mental game. And he did it against, later on, as we've talked about before on the show, against Hagler, which is just an incredible, incredible story in its own right. But against Roberto Duran, he watched that film over and over and over again of his 15-round loss to Roberto Duran. And when he set out to fight him again the second time, he knew that Duran was such a prideful guy, and he was such a powerful guy. Again, the Hands of Stone moniker, 71-1 with all those knockouts at that time. He knew that Duran wasn't happy with having only won the decision. He wanted to knock him out. And so he decided he would make Duran mad, and he would fluster him. And he went into the fight, the second fight, against Roberto Duran, did Leonard. And he embarrassed him with just some... I mean, he's doing this against a guy called Hands of Stone, sticking his chin out at Roberto Duran's face, like putting his hands down and he's like, there it is, go ahead, come on, crack me, come on, do it. You know, and then of course when Duran would go for it, he was just so ultra quick with Sugar Ray Leonard. And he just had guts beyond belief. He had brains and guts, the likes of which you just don't see in very many fighters. Ever, let alone today, did Sugar Ray Leonard. And I'm supposed to be praising Duran here, but now I'm reminded of this fight. Anyway, he just, clowned Duran for 8 rounds. Taunting him, mocking him. Duran was trying to get him on the ropes the way he did in the first fight. He would just slip away and then mock him and stick his jaw out some more. You know, he would hit him with bolo punches. He would just, do the shuffle, the Ali shuffle that he kind of made his own. And he just flustered Duran so much mentally that in the 8th round, Duran did not come out for the bell. Or no, I take that back. Not did not come out for the bell. It was in the middle of the round. He couldn't catch Leonard anymore. He couldn't catch him. And every time he tried to catch him, Leonard would counterpunch and pop, pop. And finally, Duran turned his back on him and waved him off and said, no mas, no mas. Which is, you know, I guess Spanish for no more, no more.
No, it is. Told, it is exactly Spanish for no more.
He told the referee in the ring, that's it, I won't fight. He was so flustered and so embarrassed by his inability to catch Leonard, he turned his back on him and walked away. Leonard, of course, the fight's still on, so Leonard's coming up and pounding him from behind, you know, and eventually he waved his hand again and saying, I quit. And Jim Cushlin, here it is in 2016. That fight happened in 81, I guess, right? That rematch happened in 81 because the first fight was in 1980. And or maybe it was late 80. I don't know. It just depends on when the first fight was. Like I said, I'm doing all this from memory as much as I can. This is 2016, so 36 years later, here he is, and you remember him only from No Mas. You don't remember the first win over Leonard. You don't remember his tremendous battles against, you know, Hearns and against Hagler. He later fought for the middleweight championship against Hagler in 83 in a tremendous full 15-round fight there. Battles against Aran Barkley. That's another one. He just had some of the most titanic battles in the history of the sport and was one of the greatest, like I said, two-fisted fighters. And when I say two-fisted, I mean knockout power with both hands that the sport had ever seen. And you remember him from, oh, that's the guy. That's who Duran is? That's the guy who said no mas, no mas? I didn't know that. Well, his whole story is going to be told now in this movie Hands of Stone, which I guess starts tomorrow night in theaters around the country.
I'll definitely have to check it out. And by the way, I did look it up. Both fights were in 1980. The first one was in June.
They didn't win the full year then.
No, in fact, the first one was in June, and the second one was in November. Now, there's something you don't see nowadays, by the way.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, just fighting 3 months or, well, that'd be what, 5 months later.
About 5 months later, yeah. That's something you don't see in boxing or MMA or any of those kind of things. They is literally turning around a couple months later. But, right. If anything, and that's partly my fault. I like boxing, but I'm not gigantic into it. And, you know, these types of times, both of these dates for these two fights, you know, I was born in 81, for example. But if anything, what my ignorance demonstrates is how famous that No Mas moment is that people remember. I think they made the 30-30 on that too.
Sadly for Roberto, how infamous it is.
No, that's true. That is very infamous from a Duran point of view.
Moment of his life. And I saw a documentary. I don't know if it was a 30-for-30, but I saw a documentary on ESPN. I think it was.
I think it was a 30-30. I recall that they did one on this thing.
Yeah, and it was the first time that Leonard and Duran had gotten together since that time. Because there was always, you know, still a bit of animosity there from Duran, I should say, toward Leonard because of that. And they just, you know, it was one of those things where the great, proud Panamanian fighter that he was, he just couldn't stomach the fact that was always going to be hanging over him. And so they got together, and I remember watching that 30 for 30, I don't know, last year or whatever it was, and the hug between those guys. And the discussion of what had happened was just, I don't know, it was something really amazing to watch. I just enjoyed every second of it, and just taking the stroll down Amnesia Lane right now is an amazing thing for me. I really enjoyed it. I'm really looking forward to this movie. Anyway, to my point on that, I'm really hoping Usher knows how to act and they don't screw this thing up because, this is a story that I'm glad. And Jim, make sure you watch this. Go to the movie. And make sure you take your child and make sure that other younger fight fans, or even if you're just a casual fight fan like you, don't ever make the mistake of only remembering Roberto Duran for No Mas, because he was so much more than that. He fought Leonard in – I pulled something up now because I couldn't do this from memory anymore. I'm just looking at Roberto Duran's career. He fought Leonard in June of 80, as you mentioned, and beat him. Lost in that TKO in the eighth, in which he quit in November of 1980. And then, let's see, then he had Wilfredo Benitez that he lost to him in 1982. That's another epic classic fighter and fight. Then I told you mentioned Marvin Hagler. That was another loss in 83. Then Thomas the Hitman Hearns in 84. And some other guys who were a little bit less known. Pepino Cuevas was a real good, solid fighter. He lost to Vinny Pazienza, too. Aran Barkley, I mentioned, he beat Aran Barkley to win the WBC middleweight title in 1989. And I'm trying to think what his age is at that time, because he's getting up there in years, and he's still winning championships. Then he fought Leonard again in what was a far less memorable fight in 89. So a full 9 years after their first two fights. And he lost to him in a fight for the super middleweight title. So he's getting up in weight, and he doesn't have the same speed and same quickness and the same knockout power and everything else. Neither did Leonard, for that matter. But that was a unanimous decision for Leonard in 89. And then he piled up some losses toward the end of his career as he got older. You know, he lost, let's see, one, two, three. He lost three of his last five fights, five of his last nine against some guys that were younger and hungrier and, you know, trying to knock out a legend and beat a legend. And so some of them did beat him in decisions. So anyway, the final record, the final career record for the Roberto Duran Hands of Stone is, as I mentioned before, 103 wins, 16 losses. Like I said, that's a... I really wish the loss number was down in the single digits, and it probably should be. But 103 and 16, 70 wins by knockout, one of the greatest fighters of all time. So, anyway, that's what playing the Rocky music will get you. They were talking about it, like I said, on one of the, whether it was Mike and Mike or First Take or whatever, but they were talking about which were the best Rocky movies and which were the best fight movies, because De Niro's in this. Robert De Niro's in this, and of course we know Robert De Niro. Well, I do. Maybe you don't. Again, Jim, because Raging Bull is one of the greatest sports movies of all time. Raging Bull, in which Robert De Niro plays struggling, you know, former champion and struggling with alcoholism and everything else, all kinds of other problems out of the ring. Jake LaMotta, one of the great, you know, stories of all time, and Robert De Niro played LaMotta, was nominated for an Oscar for that. And he's in this one. So he was doing the interviews, and that's how they got to talking about Rocky movies and all the others and some of the great fight movies. And this is going to be a great one. At least I hope it's going to be a great one. I'm really looking forward to it. It comes out into theaters tomorrow. I won't be there on opening weekend. I just don't have time to go to movies much anymore, but I will try to make a point of seeing this sooner rather than later. All right. Anybody, by the way, this is just kind of a riff we got off on. I really wanted to get into a few of those other things, including you mentioning Jim Cushlin, that the, Tigers finished off the Twins today. The Indians have to get a win tonight in order to see this lead or to keep this lead from dropping down to four. It's 4.5 right now?
No, it's five even right now.
It would be 4.5 by the end of the night.
Correct.
The Indians aren't able to solve Cole Hamels.
That is correct, yes. Okay.
And their offense has been in as big of a funk in the last couple of days against the A's as Josh Tomlin has been for the last month. And it's Tomlin versus Hamels, so not a good sign for the Indians. I would like to get into that story a little bit, but I do want to just throw this out there since I just kind of monologued and riffed stream of consciousness on Roberto Duran in the fight game. Anybody else who's a little bit older than Jim remembers the Roberto Duran and remembers Leonard and remembers Benitez and remembers Hagler and remembers Hearns and remembers who else from that era, Pryor, and although he was a lightweight too, and Arguello, that just was a fight time for the ages. And I'm not saying that because it's from when I was younger. I'm saying for the ages. I'm saying that older people than me in their 60s and 70s remember those fights and just remember them with glory and with just passion. And younger people, if you go back and watch those and YouTube those fights, you will agree. Those were just, that was one of the greatest eras in the history of boxing. And Roberto Duran was a big piece of it, so I can't wait for that movie. Anybody who wants to kick that around a little bit and talk about Duran, talk about Leonard, talk about Hearns, Hagler, and the rest, I would enjoy the hell out of that. All right, so we'll get you up and on the radio as soon as we can at 866-240-1065. Before I do that, how about we give you baseball tickets? I got one pair left. I've been doing this to you all week. Well, for you all week. Mud Hens and Clippers tomorrow night, Fifth Third Field, at Fifth Third Field, as they say, Columbus and Toledo. I got a pair of tickets. You want to go to the game? We got tickets for you. Free pair to caller number 10 now at 866-240-1065. Good luck to you from your friends at the ticket.
Be part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 1065 The Ticket.
Rolling on indeed, it's 4:39. We'll take you until drive time with Miller coming up at 5 o'clock right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Still lamenting the state of things in the American League Central right now with the Josh Tomlin versus Cole Hamels matchup tonight. The Indians losing two in a row to the Oakland Athletics and now going right into the fire, for goodness sakes. Hey, James Harrison had his meeting today with the National Football League. So did Clay Matthews and Julius Peppers. They actually met yesterday. And according to sources, the NFL's interviews with the players, named in the ridiculously and already immediately discredited Al Jazeera report on performance-enhancing drugs, Yeah, they turned up to be absolutely without any evidence whatsoever. These meetings were held. These guys were summoned to the league meetings for no reason whatsoever. The NFL refused to answer Harrison's very simple question a few weeks ago, and that is, why do you want me to meet with you? Do you have any other evidence against me, or are you only going by that Al Jazeera report? Because if you're going by the Al Jazeera report, guess what? The main source for that report recanted every word that he said. Al Jazeera, as a news organization, has since closed and folded operations in the United States. So why am I meeting with you unless you have something extra on me? The league wouldn't even say, yes, we have something else to discuss with you. They wouldn't do it. They just demanded and said these guys must meet with them by August 25th, or they were going to be suspended indefinitely by the league. This, to me, is one of the most blatant abuses of power that a league has used against a player or a series of players, or in this case a group of three players, that I've really ever heard. And that actually goes to four players because Peyton Manning had to go through this nonsense before he retired at the end of this past season. But they have no evidence whatsoever that they did anything wrong. But because some discredited news organization quotes a source who immediately recants and says, no, don't go forward with that story, it's not true. It's not true. I'm recanting. They run the story anyway, and now these guys have to somehow prove themselves innocent instead of having to be, instead of being presumed innocent until proven guilty. And there's a big difference there, of course. They had to go there and explain that they haven't done anything and answer I don't even know how many questions or how long this took. But they had to submit to the interview, and they now say, according to sources, they were not confronted with any new evidence. Free agent defensive end Mike Neal, that's another guy. That's the other player the league plans to interview in connection with this Al Jazeera story from this past winter. They interviewed Manning back in... Oh, goodness. Oh, well, you know what? It was in the offseason. It was after he actually officially retired. But they did want to just interview him and clear his name so that there's no speculation hanging over him in retirement. The expectation of Matthews, Peppers, Harrison, and Neal, as articulated by Harrison yesterday, is that the NFL's investigation will now conclude that the players did nothing wrong and that the league will issue the same statement for them that they did for Manning in retirement. Major League Baseball player Ryan Howard and Ryan Zimmerman, also named in the report, were publicly cleared by MLB last week after they concluded their investigation. Do you have any problem with these guys being forced to go to meetings with the league in the middle of training camp, distracting themselves and their teams from their preparation for the season that begins in a little over 2 weeks? Having to go there and answer questions and clear their own names because somebody said something with no evidence, with no vials, with no videos, with no documentation, with no anything that they have to go. I mean, if the league can do this to individual players, and this is the problem I have with, and I've heard some people complain about this, but not nearly as in as much depth as I really think they need to. The slippery slope is the issue here. If a woman, a groupie, and there are many of them, as you know, that flocked NFL hotels in every single road city. If a groupie goes to a news outlet and says, player X fathered my baby, and he's not paying his child support, completely out of the blue, does the league get to bring this guy in and say, hey, this was on a news report. She said, you fathered her baby. And I know you have a wife and three kids of your own at home, but this woman says that you did this. We need you to take a paternity test? Does that player have to come and prove his innocence just because somebody alleged something without any evidence at all? They wouldn't even make the woman provide a blood test. They wouldn't make the woman provide text messages shared between the two that indicate they'd ever even known each other. Is that how it's going to be now? Because that's a problem I have, especially in a PED world. Especially when you still have, you know, the Russian Olympic team just completing the games in Rio. Well, half of them, because half of the team got suspended for state-sponsored doping, PED use. In a PED world, is that all it takes now? Is that what Roger Goodell is saying? That all it takes is for somebody to accuse you, and you have to then prove yourself innocent before we will consider you so? That's a big problem for me. And I hope that's something... And we talked about this for a couple of days this week. Ramon Foster of the Pittsburgh Steelers was talking about how the players need to start putting money away. He's the player rep for the agent for the union. Put money away now. Start doing it now and over the next few years to be prepared for a 2021 lockout or strike. Put some strike money away so that you aren't in dire straits at that time. And we know the stupidity of that because the vast majority of the players playing today will not be playing in 2021. Only the young star quarterbacks and star players who plan to play longer than 5 years would really have to worry about this. But that aside, this was over potentially the drug policy and the marijuana policy of the National Football League. They test for it, obviously, and then they suspend people if they fail the test. And the other leagues don't even do that. But this is something that I hope the NFLPA, I hope DeMaurice Smith is paying attention, and hope he realizes this just cannot happen. This cannot happen that players are pronounced guilty before they prove their innocence. By calling them to testify or to give sworn statements because of an erroneous, recanted news report from a discredited, out-of-business news agency, to make these guys go through all that, to me, is just it should be something that's in the violation of the collective bargaining agreement.
And my opinion on this, honestly, really, Bob, hasn't changed since we first brought it up, I think, early last week. And my opinion of it was thus. You know, even when the NFL is sort of trying to do something right, they still find a way to bungle it up. What did I mean by that? Well, it is the era of sports that we live in. You do want to, you know, check on the PED allegations. But then the minute that all the story gets recanted and all that stuff, it should have just been dropped.
Well, the checking was over then.
Right, that's my point. But Roger Goodell, being Roger Goodell, that ain't good enough for him. So even when they were sort of trying to do something right, they still screw it up.
Yeah, I mean,
my opinion hasn't changed in the last week and a half.
I personally don't understand how they couldn't have just said, oh, wait a minute, what is this? The accuser recanted everything? Thank you, gentlemen. This ridiculous chapter is over now. It's closed. Why do they go on to investigate something that the accuser said did not happen
right.
anymore?
Right.
It just doesn't make any sense at all. And what it does do is it creates a rift. It divides.
Sure.
It furthers the divide between the Players Association and the owners over something that is absolutely ridiculous.
And in the NFL, of course, that has the most potential to blow up. That's why you referenced the player who's talking about get your strike money ready. Because how many times have we kind of also said, especially relative to certainly baseball and basketball, the NFL Players Association is one of the weakest relative to the other couple of sports. So that's when they sign in these collective.
Are they the weakest because they're weak, or are they the weakest because they have less leverage than the other sports do? Again, in terms of guaranteed contracts and
maybe a little both. I think it might be a little both then in that case. But
yeah.
But either way, they put themselves in these positions with those CBAs, and then idiotic things like this come up. And they have to report to the commissioner or else.
Yeah, and that is very, very troubling to me, is they do negotiate this collective bargaining agreement, giving him that vast power, and then they complain about the power. And they're right to complain about the power,
sure.
Because Goodell isn't using it properly. He's abusing it, in fact. But they gave it to him, so they really don't have much room to complain here.
And that's obvious to pretty much everybody. I mean, honestly, at this stage in the game, Bob, I can't imagine anyone who's not amongst the club of owners that actually likes / approves of what Goodell's been doing. I have yet to meet any single person on the street that said to me, oh, yeah, Roger Goodell, he's awesome. That person doesn't exist unless they're amongst the owners.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, they're getting more bold about it, by the way, more and more brazen. You heard Harrison in an interview about this ridiculous thing he was going to have to go through talk about, quote, that crook. He goes, I mean Commissioner Goodell. He called him a crook. No, no joke. And then was it Aaron Rodgers? Arguably the face of the National Football League right now. Was it yesterday or the day before?
I think it was the day before.
Said something, and I'm paraphrasing here, if you have it in front of you, you can correct me, but said something to the effect of, there are very few players in the league who believe in anything the NFL says anymore, or anything the NFL does anymore. That's what Aaron Rodgers said. And this is all because, and then you got Josh Norman, I mentioned that too. Josh Norman, the outspoken defensive back, cornerback for the Panthers, or now for the Redskins, talking about Roger Goodell, and he called him, what was it? It wasn't a crook, but it was just like a Harrison,
Aaron Rodgers,
but it was something just as derogatory.
Hang on, I think I found the story. Keep going. Give me a minute to find the quote.
Yeah, he criticized Roger Goodell very pointedly and really in a manner of very, very, very much disrespect and probably insubordination. Not that he works directly for Goodell, so Goodell isn't his boss that he's kind of being insubordinate to, but they all work for Goodell to some extent. Because they all work for their owners, and the owners have selected 32 strong Roger Goodell to be their
right.
their spokesman or their you know their leader, and so technically it is insubordination. But they are just becoming more and more brazen about criticizing Goodell after the Ray Rice fiasco, after the Hardy situation, the Chris Brown thing now, and of course all these players with Clay Matthews Jr. and James Harrison. It is just such. A we'll figure it out as we go kind of an atmosphere created by Roger Goodell that the players have had it and they're now exposing it and they're now not afraid to call him out on it.
Yeah, clearly over the course of the last year or two, one or all of those possible events and probably other things was a line crosser, and now you do get that vibe from the players of I don't really care what I say about him anymore. I'm just going to say it.
Yeah,
we
and I don't
crossed
blame
the line
either.
Somewhere in the last year and a half, 2 years, and let the speculation abound. It could be any one or all of the various incidents put together.
Yeah, and this is what Norman said about Roger Goodell. He said, I get that he makes the owners money, but literally anyone could do that. A dog could do that.
Right.
He's a dog in a suit. Horrible. He's straight horrible. End quote. Holy cow. I mean, think about what that means.
Yeah.
This is a guy who's basically saying the commissioner of the league is a dog in a suit. He's horrible, straight horrible. They're not even pulling punches anymore. And guess what? If any of them, I'll tell you what, Josh Norman, James Harrison, Aaron Rodgers, you better not screw up even once, because if you ever have to go before this guy, the commissioner, for a disciplinary hearing of any kind whatsoever, he's going to remember dog in a suit. He's going to remember crook. He's going to remember the culture created by Roger Goodell's NFL, and that's what Aaron Rodgers said, and I'm paraphrasing that. Let me see if I can pull up the quote just real quick here of what Aaron Rodgers said about Roger Goodell. But he essentially, the paraphrase was something to the effect of nobody in the NFL now trusts the National Football League. They just don't believe in anything that the NFL says, because Roger Goodell has created such a culture of distrust because of his all-powerful, I am the judge, jury, and executioner attitude in the National Football League. And I cannot find the quote from Aaron Rodgers now, so we'll just have to go with that.
I've said it time and again on these types of subjects when Roger Goodell comes up, Bob. You know, it makes you long for the days of Paul Tagliabue. And then in those days, you were longing for the days of Pete Rozelle. My, how far it's fallen since then.
Yeah, and I think they're getting ready for a battle. You know, I think they're getting ready for a battle that they've never really, that Goodell probably has never expected before or ever expected would get here. But he is taking, when I say he, I'm talking about some of the brightest, most powerful, from a player standpoint, names in the National Football League are taking this guy on and saying that they are being bullies, that Goodell is being a bully, and that they are not getting a fair shake. Aaron Rodgers said this. I do have this much. Aaron Rodgers did say that it's on us, meaning the players, if Roger Goodell gets to be judge, jury, and executioner. He said it sets a very bad precedent that the league gives any credit whatsoever to wild accusations like the Al Jazeera report, and that they get to go on this wild goose chase, or if you want to refer to it in a different way, you know, that they're going on this witch hunt against players like Matthews and Harrison and so forth because of the Al Jazeera report. He said it sets a bad precedent, and that, quote, if it is the case that Goodell has too much power, we have nobody but to blame but ourselves, because we had the opportunity in the CBA to make some legitimate changes to that. I think there's probably too much pressure to come back to a deal when we had all the power on our side, and that was something we should have negotiated in the CBA, because this shouldn't be someone who is judge, jury, and executioner. Two things. He's right on both of them. Goodell should not be judge, jury, and executioner when it comes to league discipline. But they did this themselves. And this is where the owners do have leverage. Jim, we talked about leverage before, and you said that maybe the NFL Players Association is the weakest of the big
players' associations, yeah.
MLB and NBA included, and maybe even NHL. I don't know, because I don't follow that as closely.
Not right. That's why I didn't want to include it.
But from this standpoint, here's where the NFL does, the owners do have leverage. Chances are very, very good that the first, second, and third things on the mind of the players when they negotiated that last CBA was their slice of the pie. How much of the pie do we get? We want salary caps going up. We want franchise tags going up. We want average value contract and guaranteed money going up. They first, second, and third things probably on their mind were money. How much more can we get? And I'm not trying to make them all sound greedy. And you know, this whole thing with Joey Bosa that we talked about yesterday, too, it really, to me, looks that way, like he is being just extraordinarily greedy and petty, and that this is something that the Chargers, who are notoriously bad about these kinds of things, to me, I don't think they bear the brunt of the blame for this. But the players were probably more all about the greed in how much dollars we get. And they probably listened to the NFL in this negotiation say, okay, you can have X percent like you want for the players of the total pie. We get this. This is how the discipline and code of conduct policy will work. Oh, okay, that's fine. As long as you give us our money, we'll acquiesce on the rest. And that's what puts them in the position they're in now, in which Roger Goodell gets to exert his authority, which is overly influential. And to me, he's utterly unqualified. Unqualified to exert that kind of authority over these guys and over this league. Because what experience, I mean, I know he's a lawyer, but beyond that, what gives him the right to decide what is equitable and fair when it comes to punishment for various A, crimes, or B, accusations of crimes that might not actually be accurate? And that, to me, is a big, big problem.
Yeah, and it's quite possible what you're talking about when the last CBA came about, because, you know, also remember, I could see, you know, your theory being correct on that. They were looking for their cash, you know, the players, which is what they're supposed to do in that situation. But they were probably primarily focused. And don't forget the time period we're talking. Remember when this CBA got put in place? There were, at the time, very legitimate questions of if the season, that I think it was 2012, would start on time. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do.
Because they went to the literal 11th hour before they signed it, and everybody just got to basically camp in preseason in time. They almost had to start canceling things. I remember at the time, me personally, Bob, I'd speculated, well, all the issues in our nation, you know, you want to get everybody out in the streets? Don't play football. Watch what happens when there's no Sunday football anymore.
That's a great
and
point.
We came real close to that actually being a reality, which, in addition to the players wanting their money, may have played a factor in, okay, Mr. Commissioner, go put in whatever you want on your disciplinary things, not really reading over how bad it was going to be. So I think the timing of when that CBA went down also plays into this.
I think it might be even worse than that. I think they knew how bad that discipline policy was going to be, and they probably negotiated and went back and forth, and they said no, and they said yes, they said no, they said yes, and pretty soon, eventually the NFL probably said, okay, come on, if we disagree on this, we'll give you another 3% of the pie. And the salary caps will go up accordingly,
guys,
and blah, blah, blah.
Forget,
and they probably said,
we got to get out on the field. It's time.
Exactly right. And so now they're kicking themselves, and they got 5 more years to kick themselves over giving him that kind of power. All right. Really, really interesting conversation. I wish we had more time for it, but it is what it is. And what it is the end of the program. Drive Time is coming your way next. Don't forget Mr. Miller. Stay right here. By the way, congratulations, Jordan Liner of Toledo. He won the Mud Hens ticket, so he'll enjoy the game tomorrow between the Hens and the Clippers at Fifth Third Field. So thanks again for being a part of the show. Thanks to Jim Cushion for helping us out at the beginning as well. And we'll talk to you tomorrow on what we like to call Free For All Friday, right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off 2 or more select major appliances. Plus, get 3 Scott's Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.